party chair, apologized. This was, you know, a major league failure. He owned up to it. And we've been there with him ever since, because we have to get it right. That's why we had a team there. And what we're doing now, Rachel, is making sure we count every vote, making sure we follow up on every lead, and then make sure we learn from this so that moving forward, we are applying these lessons so that everybody will have confidence in every primary or caucus that we have.
DNC Chair Tom Perez speaking with Rachel Maddow last night. He's called for a re-canvassing in Iowa after this week's caucus disaster. The AP says the contest is too close to call a winner, with former Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Bernie Sanders virtually tied. They're separated by 0.1%, apparently. Well, the tight race in Iowa and how the primary process could unfold next week in New Hampshire and the buildup to Super Tuesday next month, all of that is creating a tremendous amount of anxiety and uncertainty in both the Democratic Party establishment and with voters on the ground. Ed O'Keefe joins me now. He's a political correspondent for CBS News and joins us from New Hampshire. Hi, Ed.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you. Also joining us, Angela Rye, political strategist and CEO of the advocacy group Impact Strategies. Welcome to you, Angela.
Thank you.
Ed, let's begin with you. Explain what this whole re-canvassing process is, and what is the difference between that and a recount, and is it actually going to happen?
Well, that's the key point. Unless somebody requests a recount, unless one of the campaigns requests a re-canvassing by the end of Friday, it's not happening. The DNC, despite its calls, cannot force the state to re-canvass all of the results. And a recanvassing is essentially reviewing the paperwork and doing the math one more time. A recount would be a much more aggressive and labor-intensive process. But at this point, it doesn't appear that any of the campaigns want to see a recanvassing, in part because it's pretty clear that when all is said and done, Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders will emerge on top, followed by Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden. And really, the only math that matters, ultimately, is who got how many national delegates to the convention in Milwaukee this summer.
Yeah, that's the whole conundrum. That's the whole problem with Iowa, right, Angela, is that even though it has relatively few delegates, it does have this outsized importance in terms of momentum and giving people an impression of who's a front runner, right?
Absolutely. I think the challenge here is multifaceted, and that is, first, as a result of Iowa, there is no clear front runner. Second, it is indicative of something that says that Democrats, when left up to their own devices, cannot run an effective primary. Third, caucuses are not how we run elections, right? It's one person, one vote. And in this instance, you have people having multiple opportunities to vote and then change their minds. And I think, finally, we have an app that was not properly tested and just a failure all around. And I think the real question is where many of us started after Julian Castro courageously asked this question, and that was, why is Iowa first when it is nearly 90% white and is not an accurate reflection of what the Democratic Party really looks like? And those are the kind of soul-searching questions the party has to begin answering, whether or not we're talking about front runners or the folks who are bringing up the rear, right? We have a real issue on our hands, and it is an issue of an identity crisis that has existed probably before 2016, but came to bear in 2016, and 4 years later has not yet been resolved under the leadership of Tom Perez. And I think that is really where we have to begin asking questions.
Right. So when you get to the identity crisis, we've been talking a lot about that. What is the Democratic Party? Is it the progressive wing? Is it the more establishment wing? Emerging out of everything that's happened in the last few days, what is the Democratic Party identity? How can we say what it is now?
We can't. Right. And right. That is exactly the point. AOC Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said brilliantly I think it was in December. She talked about how in another country, she and Joe Biden would not be in the same political party. And I think that is really what we have to wrestle with. If all of these folks with differing policy perspectives and political agendas are to exist under one tent, that tent has to take heed to, has to respond to the needs of people with vastly different approaches to areas of policy and the ways in which people govern their lives. That is a really tough question to wrestle with, but it's one that we can no longer ignore because it's coming to bear in all kinds of ways, including who got the contract to develop this app for the Iowa caucuses, right? Like, we have to really wrestle with these things. They're real issues and they're not going away.
However, Bernie Sanders emerged victorious from Iowa, and it looks like he's leading in the New Hampshire polls. So doesn't that tell you something about, well, the progressive wing of the party gaining ascendance?
I think you can say that, but I think the reality of it is Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders are in a statistical dead heat. Right. Pete Buttigieg's ideologies around what makes sense for healthcare, around student loan debt, on a black agenda differ vastly from Bernie Sanders. So I think that what you're really seeing is there is an even split between the ideologies. And I just don't want to get away from that because I think that is a tough reality. You also have the harsh reality of Joe Biden placing in a distant fourth in the Iowa caucuses when he was a clear front runner from what would be deemed the party establishment. So there are still a number of things that the Iowa caucuses tell us about our narrative. And mostly what it tells us is that we're unclear.
Exactly. We're as unclear as we were heading into the caucuses.
Yes.
Ed O'Keefe, is it any clearer up in New Hampshire?
No, not necessarily, because at this point, Sanders and Buttigieg are running 1-2 in various surveys, and they're pretty close to each other. And, you know, there's been some daily tracking surveys or surveys that sort of come out every few days that are being run by the same organizations. That so Buttigieg surging and with the potential to possibly surpass Sanders up here, who enjoys not only geographic advantage since he's from neighboring Vermont, but also just a familiarity advantage because he's run before, obviously, back in 2016. The one potential advantage for Buttigieg that either helps make his case or muddies the waters, at least when it comes to the issue of the ideological argument of the party, is remember that independents in New Hampshire can participate in the Democratic primary. Buttigieg, more than most candidates, has been making a play for those kinds of voters, as well as what he likes to call future former Republicans. And so if he can convince enough of those independents to help show up on Tuesday for the primary, he could very well prevail and help make the case that he is the candidate best positioned to win back people who might have supported the president back in 2016.
And that is also Elizabeth Warren's territory. She is the senator from Massachusetts nearby. What happened to her?
Well, you know, she had been credited throughout the Iowa stand, at least, as having one of the sharpest organizations there in the state. And arguably, she had the third best one since she has placed third. The problem for her is that she's in the same exact lane as Sanders. And if you're inclined to support a more liberal Democrat, you either are going with Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Because the two of them have essentially refused to distinguish themselves from each other, you're just picking, you know, which of the two you prefer. And what I kept hearing from voters in Iowa, and what we've heard a little bit here in New Hampshire, is consistency. That throughout his career, Sanders has been the way he is, has believed in what he talks about. Whereas Warren has come lately to the concept of Medicare for All, is a former Republican, and is someone who hasn't necessarily been as clear in her beliefs over the course of her shorter public service career.
And Angela, what do you expect to see in tonight's Democratic debate in New Hampshire?
I don't know. I think I expect to see more of the same. Unfortunately, the debate stage, since it became substantially less diverse, also because of the Democratic Party rules with funds raised and polls, you know, people of color aren't qualifying to be on the stage. So unfortunately, it's a very whitewashed debate stage. And I think we're not going to hear much different than what we've heard in the last debate or the debate before that. Mm-hmm. I know that folks are, you know, eager to regain their placement or at least perceived placement from before the Iowa caucuses. So maybe from that standpoint, we'll see people being a little more aggressive and taking the kid gloves off. But I think we'll hear more of the same people's policy prescriptions haven't changed since the last debate.
Yeah. Well, after New Hampshire, of course, there's Super Tuesday, and that's a lot more, there'll be a lot more diversity in the electorate. Do you think that Biden will then do better? Do you expect Michael Bloomberg, for example, to sweep in and get a lot more attention, a lot more votes?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. I think Mike Bloomberg has certainly paid his way through this election. He has utilized the funds that he's once given to candidates on the local level, including mayors that have a lot of influence in their local communities, to come out for him. And he's even done that with black mayors when he knows that black constituencies, for example, are struggling with the fact that he was the one to hold up the Central Park Five settlement after they were exonerated, or that he was the chief architect for stop and frisk in New York. And so to utilize black mayors in the way that he's doing it is strategic, but it also undermines their own credibility with the constituencies rather they serve locally. So I think that this will be very interesting, and to see how Mike Bloomberg pivots from where he once was as mayor of New York City.
Well, and also when you're talking about the African American electorate, they still, according to polls, overwhelmingly support Joe Biden, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But I'm just saying from what he's doing, you can see that it's clearly targeting what he knows, what Mike Bloomberg recognizes as a clear base for the Democratic Party, even when the party can't see it itself.
I'm curious, Angela,
Yeah.
what is the problem with Pete Buttigieg in African American communities? Why can't he get people of color to support him?
You know, Pete actually had a great answer to this on my podcast. We sat down in South Carolina just a couple of weeks back, and we talked about his support in South Carolina in particular. And what he said is that they don't know him and he has to earn their support. And I think that's exactly right. I've been really frustrated with some of the think pieces that have come out calling Black people homophobic, as if there's more homophobia in the Black community than there is in any other part of the country with any other race. It's just not real. But the question around his support and what he has to do, I think, are monumental, and it demonstrates that he really is a candidate that gets it. The other point that I would raise is simply this: before Iowa, Barack Obama in 2008 also did not have the support of Black people as a Black candidate. What you saw after the Iowa caucuses is that Barack Obama's support shifted with the Black community because he then became electable. They saw him win in a state that was more almost 90% white and decided, if white people can do this and they will do this, maybe we should take this chance. And so it is a tr truly it is a book. So you're right, it's a doozy. But I think that's one other point we have to consider, the fact that when they saw a narrative shift from a very white state, Black people came around as well. And they came around for South Carolina in particular. And we know that right after New Hampshire, there's South Carolina. So I think that we'll see if Pete Buttigieg will continue to walk in the vein as Barack Obama. We've heard him sound like him a lot. He definitely has a funny last name, like our former president. And there's some other similarities there as well, including the fact that he organized in Iowa for Barack Obama. So let's see what happens. But I wouldn't put us all in one bucket just yet.
Okay, we will stay tuned.
Thank
Angela Rye, she's a
you.
political strategist, host of the podcast On One, Ed O'Keefe from CBS News. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Great to be with you.
Coming up, why the NFL is so white. Only three Black head coaches, despite a diversity effort put into place 15 years ago. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The NFL has a race problem. It existed long before Colin Kaepernick chose to take a knee. And here's the problem. 70% of NFL players are Black. But when it comes to head coaching jobs, they're mostly shut out. Of the 32 teams, there are currently 3 Black coaches and just 1 Latino. The rest are white. And when Blacks are hired, it's typically for losing franchises where the turnover rate is pretty high. This is all despite a 15-year-old rule known as the Rooney Rule, which was meant to address diversity. Joining us is Jerry Brewer, sports columnist for The Washington Post. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us, Pamela Newkirk, journalism professor at New York University and author of the book Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, let me play a clip of tape from NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell when he was asked about the lack of coaching diversity at a press conference before the Super Bowl. Here's what he said.
And that's where the Rooney Rule really works, in the sense of making sure that every club is required to not only interview, but also consider seriously candidates with diverse backgrounds and make sure that they're hiring the best people. And I think that served us well, but there's still a lot more work to do.
Quickly, Pamela, what exactly is the Rooney Rule?
Well, the Rooney Rule was devised about 15 years ago after civil rights attorneys Johnny Cochran and Cyrus Murray released a report looking at the dearth of African-American coaches in the league that was somewhat like 70% Black when you look at the players. And as a result of the research, like looking at the metrics in the NFL, they came up with this rule that required teams to at least include a diverse slate of candidates in front office jobs and for head coaching jobs. And within a few years, the percentage of Black coaches, I think the highest it ever got was 8 out of 24 coaches. But now, as you know, we're back down to 3.
Jerry, why are we back down to 3? Why hasn't this Rooney Rule really worked?
Well, there's no teeth behind the Rooney Rule. I mean, ultimately, it is a set of recommendations. There are some things that are required in terms of who you have to interview, but there are a million ways that teams skirt the Rooney Rule. And ultimately, you're talking about, you know, the Rooney Rule is established as if teams are going to, when we fire a coach, okay, we're going to go through a process of hiring a coach, and we don't know what we want to do. And ultimately, the reality is, in all sports, that there are a list of candidates just in case a coach leaves, retires, or is fired, and there are not Black names on that list, the list of people that you have vetted before you even go into interviews.
Okay, talk a little bit about the Sean McVay phenom. He is a phenom, right? He is a young coach of the LA Rams, and he's a white guy, and what that has done to the field for other teams.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, that was an issue a year ago. Sean McVay, the head coach of the Los Angeles Rams, led the Rams to the Super Bowl in his second year as a head coach. Got off to just this fantastic start, seemingly out of nowhere. Got hired at the age of 30 and just this young offensive mind. Then all the owners wanted the next Sean McVay. So a lot of young, white, offensive-minded coaches got jobs in the last coaching carousel, which was for the 2019 season. It did not continue as dramatically into this run, which is something that frustrated a lot of Black coaches. You know, they're essentially saying, wait a minute, you told us that you wanted offensive guys. Well, here are some offensive guys, and a lot of them did not get interviews, and the most prominent of them, Eric Bieniemy, the offensive coordinator for the Kansas City Chiefs, who just won the Super Bowl, who have the state-of-the-art offense of the NFL, he didn't get a job offer. And so that was very frustrating for Black coaches.
Right. And then you have Cliff Kingsbury, who is a white guy, and he was fired from a losing college team, and he was just hired by the Cardinals, right?
Yes, he was hired by the Cardinals before last season, had a losing record in college, and the Arizona Cardinals ultimately said, that doesn't matter to us. I mean, he got fired from his alma mater, Texas Tech University, where he was a star quarterback, put up record numbers. But Arizona said, it doesn't matter. What we want is a head coach of the offense, and we will worry about the defense by hiring a head coach of the defense. And a lot of coaches are saying, now, wait a minute, you know, this has never been done this way before, and it can't just be the Sean McVay effect. You know, why are you guys playing copycat in this manner, in a manner that we've never seen before? And what happens in Cliff Kingsbury's first season? He has a losing record with the Arizona Cardinals. Hmm.
Pamela, overall, the NFL has an image problem when it comes to race, what with Colin Kaepernick. Can you talk about that, sort of the bigger picture with the NFL and how they're trying to address this?
Yeah, this is the problem, and it's not just the NFL. It's like most major institutions. As soon as they have a black eye over some embarrassing episode, in this case, it's the blowback over Colin Kaepernick, or then they look for a black face to put out in the public to sort of cover up whatever scandal that there is. I mean, we've seen it in fashion, with Prada. They have this offensive iconography in their work, and then they hire diversity czar. They put, they pull in a high profile black person to suddenly become the face of the organization. But, these are public relation ploys. They're not effectively addressing the matter at hand. And what we're looking at is a league that has not yet diversified its ranks when you look at coaches, front office positions. And it's a problem that they've acknowledged for years now. And this is not rocket science. It's not something that they cannot address. The Rooney Rule is just one strategy that they can use, but the strategy doesn't work without will. It requires them to have the will to actually address the issue. And, there are so many different ways they can do it.
Well, very quickly, we have a minute left. What is one way that they could do that?
Well, one of the things, the Rooney Rule is just looking at, part of the pipeline problem is they can add offensive coordinators to, requiring them to add them, that position to the ranks of people who where you need to have a diverse pool. I mean, they can look at more creative ways to increase their ranks. They could, look at the number of African American quarterbacks and mentor them to become head coaches. I mean, this is not something that is beyond their reach. I mean, this is something they can do if they want to do it, but it requires will.
Pamela Newkirk, she's author of the book Diversity, Inc., The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business, and Jerry Brewer is a sports columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, how new visa rules demanding years of social media posts has dissuaded foreign documentary filmmakers from coming to the U.S.
This has a chilling effect. If you're a filmmaker working in a country where, you're working under a repressive regime, you may have a pseudonymous social media account through which you communicate with sources, with subjects.
Plus, the Syrian director of the Oscar-nominated documentary The Cave. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Sundance Film Festival wrapped this weekend, and the Oscars are coming up on Sunday. Filmmakers from around the world have been traveling to the United States to promote their films and hit the awards circuit. But new visa requirements and President Trump's travel ban have made it difficult for people from certain countries to get here. Firas Fayyad, the Syrian director of the Oscar-nominated documentary The Cave, only got here last week after initially being denied a visa.
The nomination came and I heard about the nomination, so and my family texted me and many people texted me, and I was like, so I couldn't get to the country through the shortlist until the nomination. So after the nomination, I managed to get here.
That's Firas Fayyad, the Syrian director of The Cave. The Iranian drama Yalda, A Night for Forgiveness, screened at Sundance without its director, Masoud Bakshi. And that film won a major grand jury prize. Well, to talk about all this, we're joined now by Simon Kilmurry. He's executive director of the International Documentary Association. And the IDA is suing the State Department over its new visa requirement. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
What is this new requirement?
Well, the new requirement is that anyone who's applying for a visa to the United States, so that's essentially 14 million applicants every year, has to give up 5 years' worth of social media identifiers on 20 different platforms.
So you have to supply your name and password to all your social media accounts that you've had for the last 5 years if you want a visa to enter this country.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's kept by the government essentially indefinitely for 100 years, and then it goes into a government archive, and it can be shared with other agencies or other governments or...
Yeah. Or who knows what.
Who knows what, yeah.
And your argument is what?
Our argument is that this has a chilling effect. If you're a filmmaker working in a country where, you know, you're working under a repressive regime, you may have a pseudonymous social media account through which you communicate with sources, with subjects, through which you do research, through which you might voice your own opinions. Now that information is no longer under your control, and it can easily unmask who those people are. And we have a number of international members who have, through our research in this suit, expressed their reluctance now to apply for visas to come do co-productions in the United States, to come present their work. And we've seen Firas just recently having trouble getting his visa renewed. We're not sure how directly related that is to this rule because we don't get that information from the State Department, but it's definitely having an effect on people.
Well, he, because he's Syrian, is part of the travel ban, so that might be a separate issue.
Well, it could be a separate issue, but he also had a visa to the U.S., and his renewal was denied, so we don't know quite why that renewal was not allowed to go through.
Eventually, though, he was allowed to get a visa, and why was that?
We don't know what the explanation is. And that's the thing about whether these things are allowed or denied. The State Department is not obligated to give you any explanation. And so it's a bit of a mystery. But it is troubling that he's not, as someone who's come in out of the country frequently over the past 2 years since his first nomination in 2018, that has been made more difficult for him through this.
Well, presumably the State Department could just do its own internet research anyway, right? I mean, this is all in public, unless, as you say, they might be using a pseudonym.
Yeah, well, before these rules were actually put in effect, the State Department's Inspector General did an analysis of a pilot project to kind of test out this rule and found it to be incredibly ineffective. You know, it's very hard to, first of all, decide what someone's opinion actually is just from a Facebook like, or if they share something on Twitter. Are they endorsing that? Or are they condemning that? And then they're using tools like Google Translate to translate international posts, which is notoriously bad at detecting idiom, tone, let alone just basic accuracy of a translation. So even the State Department's own Inspector General has said this is not an effective tool to decide whether or not someone should be allowed to come into the United States.
Although, as you say, that this is a requirement that applies to everyone seeking a visa, not just filmmakers or the media.
Yeah, so, and goodness knows, does the State Department really have the resources to properly analyze? And like I said, with all those problems of translations and, you know, tone and whether something is an endorsement or not, do they have really the resources to analyze 14 million applications where you have to give up your social media identity on 20 platforms? It's just exponentially a huge task, which I very much doubt they have the resources to do properly.
Well, thank you for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Simon Kilmurry, Executive Director of the International Documentary Association. We just talked about director Firas Fayad and his troubles getting to this country. He's here to attend the Oscars on Sunday, where he's nominated for his documentary, The Cave. It's about a hospital in a rebel-held area outside Damascus. Hospital staff built underground tunnels and bunkers to protect patients from bombs. And the hospital is run by Dr. Amani Balour. She's the first woman to run a hospital in Syria. I spoke with director Firas Fayad last week, just a few days after he made it to this country. You focus on a hospital and you focus on the woman who's running it.
Yeah.
Dr. Amani Balour. She's, well, she turns 30 in your movie, so she's young. And how did she, a woman in a very strict Muslim country, become the director of a hospital?
Dr. Amani was one of the few women who has managed to turn to be a leader of this hospital. And she's the one, the lowly manager in the history of Syria to lead a hospital. And I feel as a, from the young generation, she represents my voice because the values she fight for, the humanity, the courage, the fight for the equality and the justice. This is a values was we are looking and fight for it against the Syrian regime because he's taking over our right for the equality, our right for freedom, our right of freedom of expression and democracy. All of this is right. And the story of the hospital where Amani been elected 2 times to be a manager for a hospital is a story about democracy. You can just symbolize this story for anything, stories happening around us in this world. And seeing this woman manage to lead an hospital to help people to survive through the most barbaric circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a scene where a man comes in looking for medicine for his wife, and she talks to him, and he said, "Why am I talking to you? You're a woman, and why are you running this hospital? You should be at home."
Yes. I feel the stories of war, it's happening and happening, but there is more social change happening leading by this is whom, and then there is more existential question that we have to stand and understand and look through them. And through this is a story, I feel there is many level of that. This is the confirmation that happening between Dr. Amani and that man. He's himself is a victim and have a victims in his life. And herself, she's a powerful woman. In this moment, we understand how much she's powerful and strong. But also in the other side, we understand there is a lot of other crew member behind her and support her and want her to be a manager for that. That show you how much the equality is important for this society, the small society that in this side, the hospital, it's our society as a Syrian, how much important for our future.
That, so you saw the hospital as a microcosm of
yes.
of Syrian
yes.
society or what Syrian society could be.
Exactly. It's like Syria under emergency situation, but inside this emergency situation, we can look to the future and like a glimpse of the future that we was wanted. We want a future that woman next to the man equal to build the future of Syria. And there's no future for Syria, for building the country, for changing for democracy and justice without seeing a woman in a strong role in every single place.
Her daily life is one filled with trauma and tragedy. She is a pediatrician. She takes care of, there are some scenes in your movie that are very difficult to watch, of children bleeding and gasping for air after being chemically bombed and gassed. Just horrific scenes of misery and tragedy. She sees that all the time, or she did before she left the hospital. And how did she handle that psychologically?
Normally, as Dr. Amani all the time was expressing her emotion, she was saying, "I can't look to the eyes of the children when I treat them. This is a lowly way. It's make me survive. Because if I look to them, I will understand this is a child who could die in front of me. It could affect me to not continue what I have to do." And she knows that she have to go through all of this death, many deaths of the children, who there is no hope like to save their lives, but she have to do all of these things. Alongside of that, she have the responsibility of serving this society that around 400 people under siege who need urgent help, who need hope, which is like considering this small hospital.
So at the end of the movie, everyone's evacuated, right, from the hospital. Where is she now?
Now she's in Paris, and she's been awarded with a very prestigious humanitarian award from the European Union. It's called Raoul Wallenberg Award. And this is the first award being given for the woman outside of the European Union. And she's doing now, she's running organizations for supporting women who is trying like to work in the medical care field. And she want to like train a more female doctor to work and help the society.
Well, I'm glad you made it here.
I'm happy so much to be here.
Congratulations and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Faraz Fayyad, director of the documentary The Cave, nominated for Best Documentary Feature at the upcoming Oscars. And joining me now in the studio is Warren Olney, host of To the Point, the podcast. Hi there, and what's on your show this week?
Well, thank you very much for allowing me to come and sit down. And
you're
we have a two-parter this week. Always glad to be here. We have two things we're going to be talking about. One is to try to make some sense out of what's happened politically in the United States between the Iowa caucus debacle and the experiment in reality TV we saw in the chambers of Congress the other day.
The State of the Union Address.
Called the State of the Union Address. And also, of course, the impeachment and how has ultimately worked out. We're also going to talk with Laurie Garrett, who is a very well-known expert on epidemics and pandemics, who is going to tell us that the Trump administration has, in her mind, intentionally dismantled the mechanism that the Obama administration put in effect after the Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa. So that the United States would not be able to respond should a similar thing happen here to the coronavirus.
All right. Well, let's hope it doesn't get that far.
Let's hope that.
Let's just hope. Okay. I guess we have to just hope then.
Yeah.
Warren Olney, he's host of To the Point, the podcast. Get it wherever you get your podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews and find out what was great at Sundance. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, happy Friday. Sundance just wrapped and the Oscars are this weekend. New movies are also out this weekend. There's a lot to talk about in the film world. And joining me to do that is Whitney Seibold. He contributes to IGN and co-hosts the podcast Critically Acclaimed. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
And also joining us, Carla Renata. She contributes to Variety and is the host of the Curvy Film Critic podcast. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Miss Madeline.
Well, it's nice to see you. Welcome.
Nice to see you too.
Let us begin with Birds of Prey. This is the latest in the Harley Quinn franchise. I guess it's a franchise now. Right?
Yes, yes.
Because now there are two.
Starring
Margot Robbie. And this time, this is an origin story of who she is.
It's oh so quiet.
Now that I cut ties with Mr. J, I'm about to learn that a lot of people want me dead.
All alone.
And at the top of that list is this guy.
And so peaceful.
But it turns out I wasn't the only dame in Gotham looking for emancipation.
Okay, so Carla, the full title of this is Birds of Prey and the
Fantabulous
Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. What?
That's my favorite word, fantabulous. I use it all the time.
all the time.
I really do.
So what is this movie about?
This movie is about Harley Quinn, who is the Joker's girlfriend, and they have broken up, and she's trying to find some solace in that. And so she decides that she's just going to go out and wreak havoc to get his attention, to let it be known, I'm over you. That's basically the premise of the movie.
As we all do.
As we all do.
Well, we women.
I love Margot Robbie, mm-hmm. and I love seeing her in this. And not for nothing, but she's like, she's just a bad diva. She's in these roller skates rolling down the street. I'm like, first Miss Thing was in ice skates playing Tanya Harding. Now she's on roller skates. I'm like, she just likes to be athletic. But she shows so many different colors in the course of this film. She shows that comedic edgy side of her that we got a whiff of in that Martin Scorsese movie she did with Leonardo DiCaprio a long time ago. And so we see that. We see her teaming up with these other women that are bad, Journey Smollett, Rosie Perez, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. And it's written by a woman, it's directed by a woman. It's just like a female fun fest.
Oh my gosh. Whitney, what'd you think?
I appreciate sort of the angle. The title doesn't just refer to the emancipation of the character. In fact, it refers to the emancipation of all the characters. Each one of the female leads has been wronged by man and male kind at some point in their past, and it's all about them settling the score and becoming superheroes in their own right. But my issue is, at the end of the day, it does feel very safe. This is, after all, a big sort of studio product. Although director Kathy Yan is doing what she can to bring a lot of energy to it, I was impatiently waiting, essentially, for the wheels just to come off this thing and for the action to really kind of start blowing my mind. And everything felt, for a film as colorful as this, weirdly restrained. And I ended up walking out feeling like I had witnessed more of a TV pilot where they were setting things up rather than...
Did it kind of lose steam? Like it starts off with a bang and then it gets a bit tedious?
The beginning is the most energetic part, Carla.
I feel the complete opposite of you. You know this. I think it's interesting to have these types of conversations, especially when it's dealing with comic book characters that are brought to the big screen. This is a DC Comics character that has been brought to the big screen by Warner Brothers. And as we know, Marvel Cinematic Universe has been ruling that lane for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So to have this and then Wonder Woman in their arsenal is kind of like, oh, okay, DC trying to come back. But from a female perspective, I was just excited to see a bunch of girls on the screen kicking butt and taking names. I was excited about that. I love the action. I thought it was real. There's this one scene where she does a backflip from the ground onto the top of this car in roller skates. I was like, yes, girl, yes. I was living my entire life for that movie. I really was. And I think that for people that were looking for more because they're huge fans of that franchise, they probably are like, womp womp.
Okay, we're going to move on to a movie called And Then We Danced. Whitney, you saw this one. It's a movie from Georgia, the country, not the state.
Right.
So it's in Georgian.
It is in Georgian.
So we're not going to play a clip. What is this about?
This is a film about a Georgian dance troupe. And we learn from this film that traditional Georgian dancing speaks very much to the character of the nation. And all the very stern instructors in the dance troupe are constantly reiterating that to the troupe, that you have to reinforce all of these very traditional Georgian values through the dance. And if you do it incorrectly, you are disgracing the nation. The main character is Merab, and Merab is going about his business, really hoping that he'll make it, like in the chorus line, with his female partner until a new interloper, a new male lead, enters the troupe. And at first it's a bit of a rivalry, and it takes the audience not too much time to realize that these two men are actually very quickly falling in love with one another. And we're trying to see how they get to express their love for one another in this very oppressive dance environment where they can dance to be free and dance to express themselves or use their art to toe the line of the more traditional values. This film has caused a huge uproar in Russia and in Georgia.
Really?
For its depiction of a gay romance. There were protests. People were arrested. Church officials and politicians got involved in decrying this film openly. It is overseas politically revolutionary because there aren't a lot of queer romances depicted in any kind of mainstream film. So I'm seeing this film here in America, having been weaned on a good number of queer romances and seeing something that is structured pretty typically, in fact. I feel like the leads do a lot to keep the tension sort of stretching, but once partway through the film, the tension has broken, spoilers there, the film gets a little bit hazy as to what it's going to be about after that. It does lose focus a little bit, and then it comes back around and becomes more about sort of personal identity versus national identity.
But for its very existence, maybe worth seeing.
Absolutely.
To say, okay, yeah, we support this.
If you support this, you know, really sort of thumb your nose at a regime that is discouraging mm-hmm. it.
Yeah, make a political statement. And Then We Danced is the title of that movie. Okay, speaking of dance, let's talk about Sundance.
Yes, ma'am.
You are just back.
I am just back from Sundance.
And can you give us some highlights, some of your faves?
So I made a conscious decision going into Sundance 2020 because I was a little annoyed at the fact that female filmmakers were not recognized mm-hmm. This award season. So I made a conscious effort to see films that were either written, produced, or starring women or people of color or someone of some ethnicity. That was my goal, and that's what I did. But one of the films that made a huge splash at Sundance was this film called Zola, and it's written by this young filmmaker named Janisa Bravo, who's kind of a little off kilter anyway, but she's really off kilter with this film. It's based on 144 tweets that were popped off on Twitter by the stripper played by Taylor Page in 2015 about this road trip that she takes with this other stripper and her pimp.
Wow.
I know, that's a lot. It sounds
that's
like a lot. But when I tell you that movie is pure comedy and an adrenaline rush, and it says so much about so many things. It says a lot about female friendships. It says a lot about how when we empower each other and work with each other, how we can defeat and overcome and overpower anybody else. It was crazy, and it was one of the first films to get picked up out of Sundance. It's been picked up by Sony Pictures to be distributed later on this year.
So we will have a chance to see it.
So you will have a chance to
Zola.
See it. Zola.
Okay, what else?
What else did I see? I saw a lot of films that were primarily dealing with women and people of color. I saw another film that was called Bad Hair. Now, this one wasn't directed by a woman, but it was written by a guy. His name is Justin Simien, and we know Justin Simien from Dear White People, right?
And Don't At Me, which airs here on KCRW.
Yes. So Justin Simien wrote this film, which deals with the societal norms surrounded around Black women and their hair. Mm. Which is crazy at best. It's
you know,
a crazy movie.
It's called Bad Hair.
It's called Bad Hair.
I want to see
Chris
that.
Chris Rock made a documentary just a few years ago called Good Hair.
Right.
Such a good movie.
So let me just explain. For people that are not people of color, let me just explain the ideology behind good hair and bad hair. So in the African-American community, you are considered to be someone that has bad hair if your hair is not of some kind of straight, really wavy texture. You're considered to have good hair if it's straight and wavy and looks closer to what somebody's that's white, what mm-hmm. their hair looks like. So that's why the title of this film is so interesting, because it deals with that societal norm, and it deals with this young lady who she has natural hair mm-hmm. and they take it back to where she gets her hair permed as a child, and the painstaking process that women of color go through just to have their hair straightened. So this young lady gets this really bad burn, and she has this scab in the back of her head from getting right.
Jeez.
I mean, it's very graphic.
Well, you have good hair.
Thank you.
I like your hair. All right. Whitney,
yes.
Oscar predictions. What do you think is going to make best? What's going to be best picture?
Best picture, Smart Money is 1917 right now.
Yeah. What's the one you want to win best picture?
Little Women is the one mm-hmm. I want to win best picture. Of the nominees, I think that one is my favorite. It's a pretty good crop. There aren't two I'm angry got nominated. I'm a little baffled by the inclusion of Ford versus Ferrari, which is a fine film, but
I'm a little baffled Uncut Gems wasn't nominated for
yeah.
anything.
Me too.
I think
I
it
like
might have
movie.
Been a little too aggressive a film. You know,
that movie was like, I needed a cocktail after Uncut Gems. Mm. That was an intense movie. It was very intense. But Adam Sandler in
he
that
was
movie
incredible.
Was wonderful. And this is the thing. I don't understand what the Academy's issue is with people who cross over from comedy to drama. Mm-hmm. I really don't get it. Like, if a performance is good, then it's good. What difference does it make what their background was? You
yeah.
know? And the same goes for Eddie Murphy. Like, why was Eddie Murphy not recognized for Dolomite Is My Name? I don't understand that. I don't get it. And I read an article not too long ago that was published in the New York Post about a Academy member who straight up, they didn't mention the person by name, obviously, but they straight up admitted that they didn't see a lot of the films with subtitles because they couldn't be bothered.
This has been circulating. An anonymous source within the community has said that they didn't like the fact that Parasite was nominated for Best Picture alongside the, quote, normal films or regular films, and that they don't like reading subtitles, and subtitles get in the way of watching a film. And we're beginning to see why the Academy votes the way it does.
Well, maybe we all need to learn Korean, and then there won't be a problem.
You know, but
so.
This is the, and
we
maybe
need to be multilingual.
And how about this? Maybe you shouldn't be an Academy member if you don't want to watch the films that are nominated.
Exactly.
How about that?
How about that?
How about that? Right. I'm just like, I'm gonna need you to watch the films that they're telling you are nominated to make an informed decision. Why are you just sitting there going picking and choosing what you want to vote? That's not okay.
Hmm.
That's not okay. Like, watch the film. A subtitle, what? You don't want to read? Are you dyslexic? What the hell? I don't understand.
No, I think the word is lazy. Carla Renata contributes to Variety and hosts a podcast, The Curvy Film Critic. Whitney Seibold contributes to IGN and co-hosts a podcast, Critically Acclaimed. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Alex Trigvadottir, Rosalie Atkinson, Brian Hartzinski, and Angie Perrin. Michelle Aloy is our line editor. Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer. Amy Ta, our digital producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Mike Stark also engineered for us this week. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to our podcast. Listen whenever, wherever you want at kcrw.com/pressplay. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a fantastic, a fantabulous weekend. I will see you on Monday.